Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 18th mass shooting at a school so far this year, which took place yesterday at a high school in Florida and has left 17 dead and 14 injured, with five in critical condition. Doug Phillips, the assistant city editor at the Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale, who was a few miles away from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, joins us to discuss what his reporters in the field are finding out today about the 19-year-old shooter, Nicholas Cruz, and the victims and their families. We'll discuss the reactions from Florida's governor, who allowed the possibility of looking into the connection between mental illness and access to assault rifles, and the different responses from Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who has an A-plus approval rating from the NRA, as opposed to Florida's Democratic Senator Ben Nelson, who is not afraid to ask the obvious question as to how this troubled young man, who telegraphed his violent intentions on social media, was not flagged by the FBI, but was able to buy a military-style assault rifle. Then we'll speak with Kenneth Nunn, a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center on Children and Families. He joins us to discuss how society clearly failed the 17 innocents who were killed at what should be a safe place of learning, and also how society failed the troubled 19-year-old shooter who had lost both parents and was displaying violent and threatening antisocial behavior on social media, having received firearms trainings from a white supremacist ethno-nationalist group. Why was he never given help, counseling, or treatment, yet was able to purchase an assault rifle, remains an open question. Then finally, we'll examine our culture of violence and America's disposable society, where not just the homeless population of disposable people is growing, but an all but homeless 19-year-old had become so alienated from his more affluent peers and seduced by violent white supremacist fantasies that he sought vindication and notoriety by slaughtering his classmates. Henry Giroux, who holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is the author of The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism and America at War with Itself, joins us. Joining us now is Doug Phillips, the assistant city editor at the Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome to Background Briefing, Doug Phillips.
Glad to be here.
And you're about, 7 miles from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida?
Yeah, although we're based in Fort Lauderdale, our office currently is in Deerfield Beach where our printing press is, and that's very close to the school where this tragedy happened.
And you've had your reporters out all day covering various angles on this story. What seems to be emerging is an extraordinary picture of a troubled young man who slipped through the cracks, who had signaled a lot on social media about his gruesome intentions and his troubled mind. He was essentially homeless. Both parents had died. His mother recently, as November. He was staying with friends. He had a sort of job at the dollar store. He'd been kicked out of the high school that he shot up yesterday. And in general, now, in retrospect, it looks like a lot of signals were mixed. What are you picking up?
Yeah, you're right about that, Ian. He certainly did exhibit some behaviors that other students considered odd. He did make some social media posting threats that were looked at by the FBI, but the connection was never made. His name was on that. But the FBI says its search of every available database and social media outlook could not connect a person to that name. So they were never able to follow up and actually get in touch with that person.
So what's the sense then of amongst the law enforcement community there? Is there a sense that they fail society? I mean, you can make the case that society failed this young man, Nicholas Cruz. He clearly was somebody that needed help. But, 17 people are dead, and surely society failed those 17 people.
Well, I think there's going to be a larger question of this individual versus this particular incident. There's a lot of the misconnections that were made, I think, go beyond just the threats that he might have made and what the FBI and others may not have found. I think there's going to be larger questions of mental health screening, and we really can't escape the gun control question that some people just don't want to talk about right now.
Well, that's the question that you keep hearing, that he bought the guns legally. So how old do you have to be in Florida? Because I think you have to be 21 to get a drink, have alcohol. But how old do you have to be able to buy an assault rifle?
Well, you're certainly right about the age of 21 to get alcohol. But if your legal age, which is 18, you can legally purchase a rifle, go into any retail store, any gun store that sells rifles. And if you can pass the in-store background check where nothing shows up as flagged as far as being a significant mental health issue, within an hour or so, you can walk out of there with a gun. And that's what he did just about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, at a gun store that's not terribly far from the school where this all happened.
And how was he able to get that gun into the school or go from where he was living? Because I understand the family he was staying with allowed him, or they knew he had this assault rifle, but they insisted that he keep it locked up. But he clearly transported it to the school and somehow wasn't noticed.
Yeah, he took an Uber hired car to the school and had this in a, I think it was like a long rifle sleeve, and got onto the campus. And the sheriff gave a bit of a description today on what he did with this weapon. He went to more than one floor of the school and started opening fire indiscriminately. One person who was heading to the bathroom in a hallway saw him loading the weapon, and Cruz told him, look, you better get out of here because things are going to get dicey in a little bit. And shortly after that, the gunfire started. But he was able to get onto the campus, into the school, and as the officer who later apprehended him said, he looked like a typical high school student, so perhaps his presence alone wouldn't have raised red flags.
But was there a connection with it being Valentine's Day and him being either jilted by some girl at the school or having some crush on the girl, or in fact being something of a stalker, as has been reported?
Well, this is what the putative leader of a small North Florida-based white supremacist group has been saying. The group is called the Republic of Florida. And it describes itself as a white civil rights organization looking for a white ethno state. And it said that he was sort of a member of that group, but the group leader said he was not acting on our behalf. And this fellow sort of made a connection between a failed romance and Cruz's desire to do something destructive on Valentine's Day.
So how are the political authorities handling this? Because, of course, the president himself has more or less suggested this is a mental health issue. No mention of guns. You mentioned earlier that there's a reluctance to deal with that issue. And Governor Scott sort of opened the door a little bit, I think, in a press conference, where at least he acknowledged that they had to deal with the intersection between mental health and access to these kind of assault rifles that this young man used on yesterday on so many people, many of whom still there are other people that are critically injured. So the 17 deaths may not be the final death toll, and a lot of people were injured. So he's caused enormous mayhem, and yet, of course, it is the 18th school shooting this year so far, and the year has barely begun. So these are pretty horrific statistics. So what's your sense about the politics down there? I know Marco Rubio, the senator, has got a high rating from the NRA. Do you think anybody's going to buck the NRA and start talking about guns?
Well, I know the students at the school, they're not afraid of talking about this at all, and they're making their voice known in a very strong way. The governor, as you did suggest, did say that he would be talking with some of the legislative leaders next week and talking about bills to perhaps make some linkage between the mentally ill and not having people with mental illness have guns. That said, the governor did address an NRA convention last year. He is considered a friend to the NRA. So I don't think anybody here is expecting any really earth-shattering legislation as far as gun control to come out of this, only because we're basing this on history. So many things have happened in the past, and virtually nothing has happened as far as keeping people who shouldn't have these guns, keeping them out of their hands.
But the governor is a lame duck, right? He can't run again. So if he's constrained by the NRA, he's doing that voluntarily, not because he's worried about re-election.
Well, there is talk that he might be challenging the senior sitting senator in the state of Florida, Bill Nelson, who is the Democrat. So he may have higher political aspirations.
I see. And Bill Nelson, of course, has not been shy about talking about the problem with the NRA and the access to firearms.
No, he's been a staunch critic thereof, and he has enough seniority in the Senate to do that. And I don't think he's worried too much about NRA support in his re-election bids.
So what do you think's happening, though, in the state in terms of demographics? My understanding is that the influx from Puerto Rico in central Florida might be changing the equation there in terms of it being less of a red state, more of a purple state, and perhaps trending blue.
Well, certainly, you know, that it could be a possibility. The influx of people from the scarred island of Puerto Rico that was hit so hard with hurricanes, you know, not sure that will make a difference too much at the polls, just because of the number of Republicans versus the number of Democrats in the state. So it may have to be something more significant than just the political demographics of the state in order to make something really happen.
Back to the students, the parents. I mean, it's pretty crazy that we live in a country where you're not safe in the streets, you're not safe in the churches, you're not safe in the schools. And is there a sense that enough already that the rights of a very small minority, I think there are about 5 million members of the NRA, their rights to have an unlimited amount of firepower compared to the rights of citizens to be safe from violence, gun violence on the very streets of their own country, along with the places of worship and schools. So it just seems fundamental that there's something wrong here to this equation. Are you hearing that from the parents? It's like, you know, this is crazy. You don't send your kids to school and be worried that they're not going to come home.
Well, that's exactly right. And certainly the parents and the community of this school, and certainly the whole community here in South Florida, is absolutely flabbergasted that, you know, this has now hit so close to home. Not that anybody was thinking that it couldn't happen, because these drills for active shooters take place constantly. The kids, when this was happening, they knew what to do, even though they were cowering and certainly scared. But I don't think any of them were surprised that it could actually happen. Whether there is a gun control answer, it isn't known, but it doesn't seem that the NRA's lock grip on the Congress of the United States is going to end anytime soon, and that's reflected in the comments that we hear today from people who have gotten significant support from the NRA, including Senator Marco Rubio.
Well, Doug Phillips, just finally, what is it you've heard from your various reporters who are out covering all this story that struck you as being some insight? Because we're just getting all of this blizzard of bits about the background of this kid and slowly learning about some of the victims. But what struck you today that you learned?
Well, we're learning more. We talked a lot about Cruz. But we're also learning more about the people who didn't survive this shooting, as well as some of those who did. And I think what is going to come out in coming days as we learn more is the sort of the heroic efforts that were undertaken by people who didn't survive this shooting, including an assistant football coach, just a bear of a man, a giant of a man who, by everybody's account, he was killed by protecting, getting in the line of fire, so that his students didn't. And, you know, although we're talking about gun control, although we're talking about Cruz, there's a lot. There's 17 people that are dead. And if we extend out exponentially the number of family members and friends that they have, we're certainly in the multi-thousands.
Well, Doug Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Doug Phillips, who's the Assistant City Editor at the Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing how society clearly failed the 17 innocents who were killed along with the troubled 19-year-old shooter. 'Cause my
does it, easy does it, they got something to say.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kenneth Nunn, a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center on Children and Families and the assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Nunn.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And Kenneth, the 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz, who's now facing 17 counts of premeditated murder, if you look at his history, is what we're learning coming out now, it's the whole society has failed this kid. He's a disposable kid. His father was adopted along with his brother. The adopted father died some time back. The mother died in November. He was staying with another family. He was completely alienated. It looks like he showed up at his former school from which he was expelled on Valentine's Day with the specific purpose of killing people, because he was apparently angry at some girl at the school who had rebuffed him. But in general, what's your take on it? I'm not... you know, being overly sympathetic to a mass murderer. But on the other hand, it looks as if there were so many signals of a troubled kid, you know, particularly in social media and everybody who knew him, that, you know, it just seems like society failed. And yet the one thing he was able to do was to buy an assault rifle.
Well, Ian, society definitely failed this young man, but also the other young people that whose lives he ended were failed as well, because the important thing is all of these factors that you have talked about certainly should have put us as a community on notice that the shooter was someone who was suffering, that he was traumatized, and that he needed some sort of intervention. And you're correct that he didn't get that, and I think that's a problem. That's difficult. But, you know, I used to say that we know what it takes to make serial killers, and I think that mass shooting perpetrators are a little bit different, but you can more or less say the same thing. If you start digging around in that history, you will find some form of trauma. Either physical trauma insofar as brain damage of some sort or some sort of severe emotional trauma. And some of the things that you're talking about, you know, insofar as the defendant, Nicholas Cruz, in this case, seem to fit that profile. He had lost his parents. He was poor. He had some sort of mental concerns and issues, and all of those things seemed to contribute toward the state of mind that led to this tragedy.
Well, I think you're right to point out that the 17 people that were killed are very much the victims, clearly, and you don't go to school and expect to be shot. It's just so wrong. And yet we have, this is the 18th school shooting this year, and the year has barely begun. So society has also failed the 17 that have died, and several more are critically injured as well. So that's something that we shouldn't gloss over in this conversation. I get that. But this is the weird part. How did this kid, they keep saying that he bought the gun legally. How come a 19-year-old, pretty much homeless kid with his backpack, working at a dollar store, staying with friends, with no friends as far as we can tell, he's toting around an AK-15 assault rifle, which he, again, they keep saying he bought it legally. Well, what, at what age can you buy a military-style weapon in Florida?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but what I do know is that it's easier to get one than it is to get alcohol in the state, because clearly, if we're talking about purchasing alcohol, you have to be at least 21, and it's clear that 19 he was able to legally purchase this weapon that we're talking about. I don't know if the age at which that's permissible is going to be 18 or 16, but whatever it is, by the time he was 19, he was able to do so. And that creates a problem. You know, I wanted to say, Ian, that I think there are really three factors that we need to pay attention to here, in addition to what you talked about, which is the fact that Nicholas Cruz seemed to be a throwaway child. When we're talking about these numbers of school shootings, one factor that seems to be undeniable is the vast availability of guns. And in fact, there's a recent article that was in the New York Times that talked about the thing that distinguishes the United States from every other country in the world is that we have at least four times as many firearms available for citizens as any other country in the world. And when you start looking at per capita access to firearms, it's really off the chain in the United States. And that sheer number of guns seems to be the factor that contributes to the number of mass shootings that we have in our country. But one issue is the number of guns. The other issue is the degree of, or shall I say, the lax control that we have, the degree that we don't control access to these guns. And that's what your point is that he's able to get guns. He couldn't get alcohol. You know, there are other kinds of controlled substances he couldn't pick up. You know, he if he had an automobile, that would be highly regulated. And these guns should be highly regulated as well, but they simply are not. And I think the third factor into play here is we live in a particular culture, and our culture is one that glorifies the possession of weapons and their use. And particularly, it seems to me that guns are an acceptable part of what I would call the angry white guy toolkit. It's something that people who have an axe to bear, who are concerned about social changes that they have no control over, seem to be drawn to, and it's an acceptable thing for them to do. I mean, if you look at Nicholas, as you were saying, he had this problem with girls. The information I've been reading seems to suggest that he had some sort of physical conflict with some women and perhaps a boyfriend. There seems to be a strain of misogyny that's there that seems to be standing out. And then the other report that I heard was that he had some dabbling with white supremacist groups. There's a group called the Florida Republic that claimed him as a member. And I think that, you know, that all of those things kind of coalesce together and are contributing to this growing number of horrible school shootings that we're having. And I think, you know, it's certainly time that we do something to try and, you know, rein that number in.
Well, of course, that's a very similar profile to the young man who murdered fellow students at the University of California in Santa Barbara a few years back. It turned out he also was dabbling in white supremacy, but had this huge grudge against women because he couldn't get a date. Again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Nunn, a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center on Children and Families and the assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida. And the white supremacist group that you referred to called the Republic of Florida, they claim him as one of their own and that they gave him weapons training. So, again, you wonder, you know, who's watching the store here? You know, we have Homeland Security. I guess if this kid would have had an Arabic name, maybe they might have flagged him at Homeland Security. But here he is posting all kinds of gruesome animal mutilation videos on Instagram, showing himself with a whole bunch of assault weapons and guns laid out on a bed, and even going on YouTube and saying that he aspired to shoot up a school.
Right.
So what more evidence do you need? And the fact that he's not considered a potential terrorist, but as I say, had he had an Arabic name, I'm sure he'd be in a database.
Well, you know, of course, when we're in the United States, I'm sure you wouldn't want us to be restricting the freedom of speech of citizens in the U.S. and arresting people who haven't, in fact, done anything wrong. They're just basically talking about it or perhaps acting in ways that aren't, widely supported. We understand. We have a sense of freedom in this country that is important to us, and that's both a political and a cultural value that we want to preserve. But at the same time, I think it's important that if people have these behaviors and they're acting out in a certain way and they may be treating women a certain way or they may be abusing animals, which seems to be part of his profile, the thing that distinguishes us from a place like Germany or a place like Britain or a place like Japan or a place like China is the fact that we have such easy access to weapons, that people who have these kinds of thoughts and behaviors can very easily get a weapon and act out their darkest fantasies in this way. If we were dealing in some other countries and they could get a weapon, they may be able to get a knife and perhaps be a threat to one or two people as opposed to an entire high school.
Well, apparently he got kicked out of the school for carrying, taking a knife in his backpack and a bunch of bullets. At least
right.
That's what we've learned. But the school apparently is in a pretty affluent neighborhood, and this kid was poor. He was pretty much close to being homeless. He's working at a dollar store. He was going to another high school in Broward County, and he sounds like he was pretty friendless. I don't think we should have dossiers and databases on anybody, but we, you know, Google and Facebook know more about us than the FBI does, you know. So we have all degrees of kind of surveillance in this country.
Right.
And it's often referred to in terms of Google as the business model as surveillance capitalism.
Right.
But it's...
Well, here's the thing, Ian. I agree with you. I think that it's very troubling that this young man was allowed to slip through the cracks in so many ways, and he seems to have been ill-served by the schools. He seemed to have been ill-served by the mental illness authorities, the medical authorities, the police, and everyone who came into contact with him. And so I think that on one side, if we had a society that cared about, human rights, that cared about the humanity of people in our society at large, And we were doing things in that way, that we were trying to support people, that we were trying to provide resources for them when they're troubled. If those things were easy to get, if we had affordable health care in this country, if the infrastructure was in place to deal with people who had mental health issues, then that would be a start. And so that's one thing we need to do. We need to make sure that we have a compassionate society that's concerned about people. At the same time, we need to make sure that we reduce the availability and the accessibility of guns and weapons that are assault weapons. And that's clearly part of it. I mean, it's ironic that one of the first acts that President Trump engaged in when he became president was to repeal the part of the federal law that prevented people who were mentally ill from gaining access to assault weapons. So I think you have to have both of those. Let's provide services for mentally ill people and for people who are troubled socially, and then at the same time we need to reduce the access to the weapons.
So what's likely to happen here? I mean, I'm sickened by these politicians saying, you know, our prayers go out and all this stuff. I mean, we've been praying for a long time for the victims of these mass shootings, and this is the 18th school shooting of this year, let alone mass shootings, and the year has barely begun. What's your sense there in Florida? Governor Scott, who, by the way, is resisting, I think, 10 of the 12 court justices on the Florida Court of Appeals have ruled in this Glock versus Doc case, as it's called, where Rick Scott, the governor, wants to forbid by law doctors talking to patients about firearms. You know, if you can ask them whether they have, you know, a dangerous pet in the house, or, you know, what medicines they have in their medicine cabinet, but you can't talk about guns as a potential life-threatening device. So that's apparently where his head's at. I mean, are you aware of this law where doctors can't?
Well, it's not a law. I mean, I am aware of his position on it. I can't say that I have a lot of expertise on that point. But what I can say is that I have seen some comments by the governor in the aftermath of the shooting that took place yesterday, where he said that he would have some support for some kinds of restrictions on mentally ill people getting access to guns. And I think that's a good sign. And hopefully it'll be the type of thing that he would be willing to carry out on, and especially since he's in his last term and will not be running for re-election as the governor, so he might have a little bit more, leeway to do things that might run counter to what his normal base would like to see. And the other thing I'm hopeful of in Florida is, of course, you know, we've had some demographic changes and certainly an influx of people from Puerto Rico, and I think there's some possibility that the base of the Florida electorate may be at a point where they're not willing to continue to support kind of mindless, gun advocacy, and they're more interested in seeing some of these changes that simply register at the level of common sense. And so, you know, we might see some changes in that degree. But I think that in order for that to happen, we'll have to see a change in the direction of the electorate, a move away from whatever the politics were that got us a majority Republican Congress and a Republican presidency. because I don't think that those, the current political forces are interested in seeing that change.
Well, certainly the president did not mention guns. He mentioned mental health and, of course, the usual cliches about praying for people, but no mention of the guns that this 19-year-old was able to get hold of and massacre people with. I thank you for joining us, Kenneth Yunnan.
Well, thanks, Ian, for having me. And, I wish you luck as you continue to negotiate these compelling issues.
Well, thank you again, Kenneth. And again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Nunn, who's a professor of law at the University of Florida and the associate director of the Center on Children and Families and the assistant director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Florida. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining our culture of violence and America's disposable society. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy. He writes regularly for Truthout, and his books include America's Educational Deficit and The War on Youth, Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence, In the Age of Spectacle. And his latest two books are The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, and America at War with Itself. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Oh, it's good to be on, Ian.
And now that we have the 18th school shooting in just this year that's barely begun, it does appear that America is at war with itself. And the extraordinary thing is that this young fellow, Nicholas Cruz, the 19-year-old, his right to buy an assault rifle, even though he's essentially homeless and he's lost his mother and father and was staying with friends and had been kicked out of the school, nevertheless, his right to buy a firearm trumps the right of the 17 people that were murdered to live out their lives. It's an amazing situation that keeps repeating itself. So you have the idea that society has failed the victims, which it clearly has. You don't go to school to die. You go to school to learn. But on the other hand, this kid seems to be a disposable kid in our disposable society.
I mean, nobody wants, at some level, to justify what he's done on the basis of the conditions in which he finds himself. But I think there's a lesson to be learned, as you're suggesting, and a larger lesson, and that is that as more and more people become disposable, as more and more people all of a sudden find themselves surviving and trying to survive in ways that impose enormous hardships on their lives and their families and others, the question that often comes, I would think, into people's minds is, you know, how do you solve this problem? How do we deal with the problems that we're facing? And it seems to me that coupled with the existential loneliness, the atomization, the lack of social provisions, and a hardening on the part of the government towards these issues, particularly towards violence, they find themselves in a culture in which the only way social problems can be addressed is basically through violence. I mean, that's why it's so difficult to listen to the responses to this killing yesterday and today. I mean, people saying we should ban assault rifles. Well, yes, we should ban assault rifles, but the real issue is, you know, much larger than assault rifles. The real issue is you have a third political party in this country called the NRA that buys politicians. You have a political system that's absolutely glued into a form of casino capitalism in which profits and power are more important than human needs. And you have a culture that's saturated in violence at every level, whether we're talking about the entertainment industries, or we're talking about the ongoing militarization of society, the acceleration of police militarization. It goes on and on. And I think that when I hear people like Rubio and Scott saying, well, we really can't talk about this right now, we really need to get to the heart of the issues, Rubio has an A-plus rating from the NRA. These people have blood on their hands. They literally have blood on their hands. We have a Congress right now that is attempting to pass a law in which concealed weapons now will not only be operative in Florida, but all across the United States. This is on the anniversary of Sandy Hook. I mean, so children are now seen as disposable because we have created a culture of violence that basically is so operative in terms of the death that it hands out to them, that it's difficult to talk about this without talking about changing an entire political, economic, and social structure.
But it's as though if you're down and out, homeless, loveless, he had a job at the dollar store, but essentially jobless and barely surviving, the one thing you can have that makes you whole, gives you stature, makes you feel good about yourself, is you've got an assault rifle. And apparently he toted this damn thing around with him a lot. And,
well,
and
I mean,
even
look,
the people that he stayed with, you know, they said, well, you can keep your assault rifle. You know, they're being charitable. But, you know,
I don't understand why that's surprising. I mean, I think that increasingly when you live in a society in which aggression and violence and a kind of coupled with a hyper-masculinity and a daily onslaught in which various social media sort of define agency by virtue of how tough you are in a survival of the fittest culture, in which aggression is not only seen as the highest form of entertainment, but the military seems to embody, according to multiple surveys, the highest ideals. I mean, what is it about a death-dealing culture and a death machine and an armed society that can get so much support from a formative culture that that becomes the prized identity that kids often migrate to when they're lost or in despair? What does it say? I mean, you know, this kid learned this. He didn't just pick up an assault rifle. Somewhere along the line, his anger was translated vis-a-vis a whole range of sources into the notion that he should hate blacks, he should join extremist groups, he should in some way participate in a culture of violence that gave him an enhanced sense of masculinity. Does that all sound familiar in light of what we're dealing with this presidency?
Well, he certainly did apparently hang out with this white ethno-nationalist group called the Republic of Florida, and he even got weapons training with them.
Yeah, he did.
So that is pretty clearly, and I suppose to some extent, at least these were people that accepted him, right? I mean, it's pretty pathetic, isn't it, when you think about it?
Well, I think it's not just simply the fact that they accepted him. I think that we now find ourselves in a culture where the highest reaches of power are ennobling a kind of violence in which those very groups that you're talking about all of a sudden claim they finally have their place in the sun. That's a much larger issue than talking about extremist groups. That means the extremist groups have moved from the margins of society to the center of society. I mean, that's a political crisis and a moral crisis and a crisis of agency and a crisis of memory. We're forgetting the horrors of the past. We're forgetting that, you know, the same kind of culture steeped in violence, militarism, aggression, hyper-masculinity. You know, in some countries, it led to death camps. In some countries, like Argentina, it led to people disappearing. In other countries, it led to different forms of violence. And I think that we need to realize that there is an element of violence in this country that now is part of its DNA. It is the narrative by which it defines itself. And it's not just about banning, it seems to me, assault rifles. It's about the pleasure that people get from a culture of violence in which, A, they tend to define themselves by virtue of that pleasure and those values, and secondly, a political culture that has been bought and sold, just literally bought and sold by the NRA.
So I think, Henry, when you're talking in the broader sense, particularly about the political DNA of the country, if you look at the national priorities, and I think the budget gives you an idea of what our priorities are, or at least what Donald Trump's from the Republicans' priorities are, we're throwing more and more money at the Pentagon than they ever got during the height of the Cold War. So in effect, we're investing in the redundancy of death at the expense of the quality of life. That is...
That's poetic and beautiful.
Well, that's...
And absolutely right.
But that is the absurdity of the American moment. And yet, every member of Congress and Senate will vote for military spending. Now, they got a little offset in the little deal they made to keep the lights on to stop the shutdown of the government. The Pentagon got an extra $80 billion for this year and $85 billion for next. And I think they got a non-defense spending around $60 billion as a kind of consolation prize. But there you have the priorities.
I mean, think of what you could do with that money in terms of addressing the question of inequality. Think of what you could do with that money in terms of building up public goods, public education, schools, educating kids about violence. Think of what you could do to launch a national campaign to study the relationship between poverty and violence, to study the relationship between the decline of the welfare state and the rise of the mass incarceration state. I mean, remember, this is a Congress that will not allow studies to emerge from the CDC on the effects of gun violence in the United States.
Right, and in Florida, Governor Scott is banning something that's referred to locally as Glocks versus Docs, forbidding doctors from telling their patients about the dangers of guns.
You know, please forgive me for this language. That sounds not only psychopathic, but criminogenic. I mean, that's actually criminogenic. I mean, that actually is a form of domestic terrorism. Because it enables a climate in which children can be killed. At the rate now, I think, of what, 58 a week from gun violence? How is he not responsible in part for that, for making that claim? How can you make that claim and not have it recognized that you've been bought and sold by a gun lobby? Who is he protecting? Is he really protecting the Second Amendment rights of anybody? Is that for real? This has nothing to do with the Second Amendment. It has to do with the fact that he's a bought politician. He's part of a criminogenic culture. He's part of what we might call gangster capitalism. You know, he's one of the chief apostles, and he has no remorse. I mean, children get killed en masse. You have the Las Vegas shooting, which is impossible to imagine, never mind to come to grips with in reality. And these people just keep passing laws or refusing laws to be passed that are willing to address the underlying and ongoing and systemic violence that is being produced in this country on their behalf.
So, did you catch the senator from Connecticut? I mean,
I saw some of the comments. Yeah,
well, I mean, he basically turned on his colleagues and said, you know, you, my Senate colleagues, are putting the life of my children in danger. So, at what point do you have a kind of critical mass in the zeitgeist in this country where people recognize the absurdity that the rights of a handful of NRA members, and at best there are 5 million members of the NRA, their rights to have unlimited amounts of firearms trump the rights of every other American citizen to be safe in the streets, in the malls, in the schools, in their churches? I mean, isn't that a basic human right that we should be able to walk the streets and go to church?
No. I mean, it operates at three levels. At one level, it's a basic human right. That safety is a basic human right. People should be able to go to church and not have to worry about being killed. People should be able to walk. We should send our kids to school and not have to worry if all of a sudden we're going to get a call and say that, you know, the children of entire families have been wiped out, you know, or a massive number, a wide number of children have been killed, disrupting families for the next 50 years. But thirdly, we need to recognize that this is also a political issue, right? We need to connect the dots. We need to realize that when you have money driving politics, that's not going to produce a culture that is in support of safety and in support of human rights and in support of basic human needs. It's going to create a culture of greed. It's going to create a culture of cruelty. It's going to create a culture of barbarism. And that needs to be changed. So at every level, these issues have to be addressed. I mean, there are people who are saying that, you know, this is a public health issue, and they're right. But it's not just a public health issue. I mean, you know, do you remember a time in your life in the United States where you have seen more extreme violence in popular culture? Do you remember a time when you have seen the police more militarized than they are today? Have you seen a time when the racism is more overt and the demonization is greater than it's outside of slavery and lynching after the Civil War than it is today? I mean, all of these pieces, it seems to me, fit into a pattern. And that pattern is we have no way of understanding that the problems that we're facing are not just about lifestyle. They're not just about individual responsibility. And they're not about mental health. I mean, actually, most of the people who commit these crimes are not mentally incapacitated. And so I think that until we have a broader understanding of this, we're in real trouble. I mean, granted, there should be reform movements that want to ban assault rifles tomorrow, and there should be, you know, a greater emphasis on checking up on people who buy these things. But that is not the answer in the long run. I mean, that's like saying that you can prevent shootings in schools by teaching more kids how to prepare for lockdowns.
Well, you know, these are kids that grow up today and start playing with video games when they're very young. I mean, I've just seen kids sitting on couches, totally absorbed with video games, and sometimes they're playing remotely with another friend. And these video games are basically about shooting everything that comes towards you. And they do these things for hours on end.
These are training exercises in the culture of death. They really are. They're training exercises. They do a number of things. They desensitize kids to real-life violence. Secondly, they seem to suggest that violence is really an entertaining sport and nothing more. And thirdly, I guess for some kids, they provide a notion of what it means to be in the world and relate to others that ultimately could, but not doesn't guarantee, that could result in the kind of violence that we see happening everywhere. I mean, I think that when violence becomes the only place where you can feel any kind of emotional uplift, you know, when violence becomes the national ideal, when militarization sort of spreads over society like a virus, you know, touching everything that we see, this is not, the desensitization is not surprising. But I think coupled that with the inability to connect these issues to larger concerns and to make claims that are purely individual in nature, I mean, like Rubio and the president not even mentioning gun violence and what this means, but simply always talking about the shooters, unstable, bad family, we can't talk about political issues now. Well, tell that to the kid, the parents of the kids who are dead.
Well, of course, the president's saying we're going to tackle the difficult issue of mental health.
But basically, that's a diversion.
Of course, but what you're saying, in effect, Henry, is that as a society, we are suffering from mental health. We are accepting antisocial, sick, and violent behavior as a norm, and our kids are being basically addicted to violence via video games, via movies. And the message inevitably is that it's a dangerous world out there and you need guns. And if you're in any way put upon, insulted, or looked down upon, having a firearm will make you feel better, make you feel stronger.
Think about what has happened post 9/11. You know, you have a culture of fear that suggests that everybody's your enemy, including your neighbors. You know, everybody has to be watched. Everybody's a suspect in a suspect society. You know, couple that culture of fear with the fact that now shared fears replace shared responsibilities. I don't know how you have a democracy without trust. I don't know how you have a democracy that's built simply on the notion of fear. Dictatorships are built on the notion of fear. I don't know how you have a democracy when, in fact, you allow punishment creep to move from the prison to other social institutions. When all of a sudden you start criminalizing endless numbers of behaviors and social problems, and you elevate violence as the only mechanism by which you can address social problems, that's a social pathology. That's a criminogenic environment. That is not an environment that democracies thrive in. It's an environment in which democracies die.
Well, here in Los Angeles, of course, we have considerably better weather than you have in Canada. And it is really appalling, Henry, to see on a daily basis more and more homeless camps literally sprouting up like daffodils in spring. It is unbelievable how much the underpasses on freeways, the sides of roads. There's a creek bed down in Orange County that they're going to do a big sweep and clean out the homeless in. That's created a certain amount of political controversy. But you don't have to be a statistician to notice that more and more people are becoming homeless.
You and I had talked about this earlier, and I think this is an amazing insight, both on your part and hopefully some of the work I'm doing. You have something new in American society. You know, it used to be that the question of social mobility was the ultimate goal by which to move into the middle class. We now live in a society where the ultimate goal is simply to survive. And one of the reasons that that's now become a major and defining principle of the United States is because we have something new here, and it's called the logic of disposability. And what that means is that more and more groups are seen as disposable. You know, as the social contract withers, or is displaced, or is derided, or is seen as an object of scorn, what increasingly we say are people are on their own, sorry, and if you can't plug into this economy, if you don't have a job, if you don't know how to make money, and if you can't consume, or if you're the wrong color, or the wrong religion, or the wrong ethnicity, you're done, you're out. We don't care about you. And I think that when a logic emerges that seems to suggest that the market becomes the only template for governing social life, something happens. You have the breakdown of society. You have the breakdown of social bonds. You have the breakdown of solidarity. You have the breakdown of compassion. When I listen to some of these politicians in the United States talk about the homeless as animals, no less, right? I mean, the metaphors that they use to talk about blacks, to talk about people who are homeless, to talk about people who are on welfare, to talk about people who are getting Social Security, how they're just mooches and jerks and just draining society. I mean, this is the language of fascism. This is the language of neo-fascism. First you demonize, then you dehumanize, and then you make them disappear.
Right, and Donald Trump's favorite word is, apart from you're fired, is he's a loser or she's a loser.
They're a loser. Exactly.
Loser. Right.
I mean, this is the language of The Apprentice, right? I mean, this is the language of reality TV. Remember, Ian? Only one person is left on the island. What kind of an ethos is that? How can a society run by that ethos? I mean, how can a society in which we share so many problems, so many issues, so many possibilities, so many hopes, so many dreams be reduced to a stupid mimicking kind of cruel logic that says, sorry, you know, there's only one winner, and if you're not it, you're a loser. Do you remember the first issue of The Apprentice? Do you remember the scene where Donald Trump they showed him in a limousine driving by a homeless person, and the implication was, who do you want to be? You want to be that homeless jerk, that loser over there, or do you want to be Donald Trump? Amass money, be successful. That's the logic that now dominates American society. And that's the logic that Republicans and Democrats buy into because they're the party of finance. They're not the party of grace. They're not the party of justice. They're not the party of compassion. They're a criminogenic party, trying to figure out the best way to keep relations of power going so that people don't realize that capitalism and democracy may not be the same thing.
Well, Henry Giroux, again, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy. He writes regularly for Truthout, and his books include America's Education Deficit and The War on Youth, Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle, and his latest books are The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, and America at War with Itself. And his forthcoming book is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.